This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at how the Fraternal Order of Police launched a smear campaign against nominee Debo Edigbile for head of the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division.
This was one of the more disgusting, racist rejections of a nomination in years, and that seven Democratic senators went along with it is a complete outrage.
Ajamu Baraka joins us to talk about an African-American perspective of Ukraine and the pathology of the liberal worldview.
Most Americans don't see what we're about to tell you. The American and European imperialist hand behind events in the Ukraine.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Last week, Senator Dianne Feinstein, head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, accused the CIA of improperly searching computers used by the Senate Intelligence Committee staff as they were looking into interrogation of terrorism suspects by the CIA.
This was a very strong accusation by Senator Feinstein about an investigation, apparently, that CIA attorneys or the CIA referred to the criminal division of the Justice Department about documents that Senate Feinstein and her staff used to help prepare, a few years ago, a 6,300-page report on the CIA's involvement in secret detention, torture, and waterboarding. That 6,300-page report has not been made public yet. Civil liberties groups and others have wanted that report made public because it really details what the CIA did and what the torture was like. Apparently, in preparing that report, they also had access to an internal CIA report that the CIA itself commissioned on what the CIA had done in terms of torture. From what I understand, or from what's understood from what Senator Feinstein said, is that a lawyer named Robert Ettinger, who works for the CIA and whose name is mentioned not once, but 1,600 times in the Senate report on torture, referred the matter of how did Feinstein's people get a hold of the internal CIA report on torture, referred that to the DOJ. That's what caused Senator Feinstein to hit the ceiling, saying, what is this? What is this intrusion into a Senate investigation committee by the CIA? What is it referring our people or this area to the Department of Justice for criminal investigation? And she really hit the floor as an outrage. And it was amazing because let's remember that Senator Feinstein has been in bed with the NSA spying and surveillance more than probably any other senator in the United States.
Michael, let's remember that this goes back to 2009 when the committee started its investigation. Listeners will remember it's because the CIA destroyed videotapes of interrogations under George W. Bush.
And you know who played a role in that?
Prosecutors exonerated the officials who ordered those tapes destroyed.
That's right. And the attorney who presided over that and gave it the green light is none other than John Ettinger, who's going after the Senate investigators.
The person in the CIA who destroyed those tapes, it was 2005, is Rodriguez. He destroyed them late in 2005 in what was called an industrial strength shredder. And basically, both Bush and Obama basically let that go. Those were tapes of actual waterboarding. So, and this attorney apparently, right? This attorney, Robert Ettinger, authorized that? Is that what we understand, or
yeah,
we're not sure?
Yeah, he did.
Okay.
The separation of powers breach here is scary because a Democratic government, the elected officials are supposed to be able to investigate the sub-branches that do work for them, like the CIA. But instead, what you have here is the CIA investigating the government and reaching into the government's computers, into Dianne Feinstein's committee computer, and taking back information that they had got, which shows stuff about the torture. So they've stood the thing on its head.
Let me just say what Feinstein said. Feinstein said last Tuesday, she spoke of Ettinger's role, that's the CIA counsel. He provided legal advice about the videotapes that were destroyed of the harsh interrogation tactics, the torture. She said he was, quote, chief lawyer for the CIA's detention and interrogation unit from mid-2004 until January 2009. That's all the black sites. That's all the waterboarding. He was the chief lawyer. He's mentioned, as I said earlier, more than 1,600 times in the study by the Senate, Feinstein said. And, quote, and this is Feinstein, and now this lawyer, this individual, is sending a crimes report to the Department of Justice on the actions of the same congressional staff who researched and drafted the report, which details how CIA officers, including the acting general counsel himself, providing inaccurate information to the Department of Justice about the program. So now you have this Eatinger guy trying to start a criminal investigation against Feinstein's staff, although basically what she's accused him of doing is perjury in her statement.
And the CIA Inspector General has referred this matter to the Department of Justice for possible criminal prosecution. Feinstein said that the search not only violated the Fourth Amendment to our Constitution, but the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and also Executive Order 12444, which, as we know, forbids the CIA from conducting domestic searches or surveillance.
So, Heidi, are you telling me that the CIA acts in a lawless manner?
It is a surprise, Michael.
Now, it'll be interesting to see what happens, because this is the same Feinstein who, we said, is in a love fest with the NSA. And, of course, when all our oxes were gored, when it was disclosed that the NSA is surveilling every one of us and going after all of us, she stood in front of everybody and said, oh, this is great. This is all hunky-dory. Now that her little Senate staff is going, they're going after them, she's all of a sudden screaming, but we'll take it. Let me tell you, we'll take it.
And
there's nothing better than a nice fight within the powers in this country.
Right. We'll see how Obama reacts.
Right. And Obama, who again said this week, I want the Senate report on torture made public. What's that saying? He can make it public tomorrow.
Right.
He can order that it be declassified and made public. So this is Obama, just, you know, Mr. Pious words.
And one question, Michael. John Brennan, who's now the head of the CIA, who tried to become head of the CIA 5 years ago, but he was too unpopular because he was identified with the torture program and they couldn't get him through the Senate, but they finally got him through. What do you think his role is in this?
Well, John Brennan, you know, according to what we know from earlier days, was involved in authorizing and being involved in the dirty torture, the dark sites, the torture, etc., well as drones and other things when he was at the Counterterrorism Center. That's why he didn't get confirmed. So basically, if we really talk about it here, we have a complete den of thieves, corrupt, you know, unlawful. I mean, what can you say? It's like it's a den of thieves up on that in Washington, just completely mad. All of them, the whole bunch of them.
Now there's one defector, Dianne Feinstein. Let's see what happens.
Amazing. Amazing to see Dianne Feinstein playing that role. Up until this, I called her Dianne Finkstein. But now we can call her Dianne Feinstein, I guess.
Now at how seven Senate Democrats broke rank to block President Obama's nominee, Debo Adegbile, to head the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division. The defeat was the result of a public smear campaign launched by the Fraternal Order of Police against Adegbile for the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund's representation of Mumia Abu-Jamal before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. We're joined today by Professor Mark Taylor, founder of Educators for Mumia Abu-Jamal, a group of teachers organizing since 1995 for a new trial. Mark Taylor is a professor of theology and culture at Princeton Theological Seminary. Mark Taylor, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The recent Senate vote represents not only increasing hostility by Republicans to civil rights, but also really a caving in to an aggressive smear campaign from the Fraternal Order of Police. As the founder of Educators for Mumia, tell us a bit about how the Fraternal Order of Police operates and describe the crux of this recent campaign.
Well, yes, the recent campaign has been foregrounded, especially on Fox television news, where you heard leading anchors and reporters connecting Debo Adegbile continually to Mumia Abu-Jamal. The Fraternal Order of Police wrote letters to media outlets. They wrote a letter to President Obama objecting to Debo Adegbile. This is fully congruent with what we in Educators for Mumia Abu-Jamal have experienced from the Fraternal Order of Police throughout the years. The Fraternal Order of Police will even stoop to maintaining a blacklist online of any of us educators around the country, not only for working for Mumia, but just for signing ads in the New York Times on behalf of Mumia Abu-Jamal's new trial or release with restitution, whatever the case, they'll maintain those charges. So the Fraternal Order of Police also will put pressure on venues that host the events for Mumia Abu-Jamal. So there's a long history here of Fraternal Order of Police intimidation.
We saw that at an event at the Constitution Center a few years ago where I believe the Fraternal Order of Police was outside on motorcycles.
These were retired Fraternal Order of Police, and we don't know which ones are still on duty and in the force because they were out of uniform. But yes, they were in mass about 30, 40 strong on their motorcycles harassing guests who were coming to the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. They were furious that there were 1,100 to 1,200 people showing up for an event observing 30 years of Mumia's confinement. The racial epithets that these Fraternal Order of Police hurled at guests, including the distinguished Cornel West, who was one of our speakers, he commented on it. My students saw this outside firsthand.
Is the Fraternal Order of Police a local Philadelphia organization, or is it more national?
It is a national organization, and in their letter to President Obama, they claimed to represent some 350,000 police officers across the country and claimed to be speaking for those 350. I actually myself believe that's a bit of a power play, that in another intimidation tactic, although we should note that there are elements of the Fraternal Order of Police all over the country who will step forward to ratchet up this venom against Mumia Abu-Jamal and unlike causes.
How does Maureen Faulkner, the widow of Daniel Faulkner, the police officer who was killed, factor into the FOP's campaign? Do they use her? Does she quote on this?
They did actually go back to Maureen Faulkner, the widow of Daniel Faulkner, to get statements against Mumia Abu-Jamal during this latest move by Fox News and other conservative venues against Mumia Abu-Jamal and the appointment of Debo Adegbile. They have always used Maureen Faulkner to be in a position as the grieving widow of the slain police officer. And in spite of the fact that there is exculpatory evidence, they don't want to discuss that. They want to play the drama of the grieving relative instead. And of course, that has powerful media appeal. It often, in our infotainment industry, it overrides argument, we know. And the FOP uses that tactic consistently.
It reminds me of the Ku Klux Klan protecting white womanhood.
It's very interesting because on the news outlets in that respect, you have the aggrieved white woman positioned on the screen when our key co-coordinator of IMAJ, Professor Dr. Johanna Fernandez, was on Fox News. She was harassed. She was cut off and yet came on just after Maureen Faulkner was being shown. So here you had a rather blatant racialization and a pitting of different ethno-racial traditions against one another, and another outworking of the white supremacy that pervades our media.
Mark, what is it about Mumia's case that has the effect of polarizing people, such that few in the legal profession have responded with public comments of outrage about this vote and the effect of the FOP's campaign?
Yeah. Well, in the first place, one has to, I believe, acknowledge the power of the media and Fox News. Last time I checked, Fox News was still commanding the largest of audiences who get their news from television, which is a powerful medium, of course. And so political pundits, people basically that want to get ahead, people that want to maintain fruitful contacts in their community, they are stepping against what they perceive as a real strong current out there. It even organizing in a city to get a press agent for some of our events, we have found that public relations officers who might support us on the matter of Mumia Abu-Jamal just know it would not be good for their business to step out there and be known as one working for an organization that supports Mumia Abu-Jamal. So there's a stigmatization that is pervasive throughout much of our culture that causes lawyers, public relations officers, and others to back away from the issue, to back away from Mumia.
What's Educators for Mumia doing in response to this recent campaign against Debo Adegbile?
We have been doing a number of things. We've been working closely with another campaign that's closely associated with us, the Bring Mumia Home campaign that Dr. Johanna Fernandez is doing a great deal of work in, heads up by Pam Africa, and her fine work with the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. These have directed much of their attention not only to the case of Debo Adegbile, but also to the Legal Defense Fund of the NAACP, which Adegbile worked for when it took on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal that won part of its appellate work and thus got Mumia off death row.
This is Michael Ratner speaking, Mark.
And I'm, yes.
I'm one thing that hasn't come out as much as it should have, and even in the liberal media, is that to defeat Debo's nomination as head of the Civil Rights Department, it took 7 Democratic senators to vote against it as well.
Right.
And they, people haven't emphasized that. And I just like your thoughts on that. And then I'm going to give you thoughts on one of them who happened to be my student a number of years ago.
Yes. Well, as a number of people have argued, we live in a two-party oligarchy in many ways, and even many of our Democrats are beholden to the influence of money and power. I understand a number of these Democrats were facing electoral campaigns. I haven't been able to check that out. But if that's the case, of course, none of them are going to want to hand their Republican opponents, you know, well, this guy supported a guy who supported a cop killer. It's kind of a guilt by crazy association, but it could have been enough to pull off a few of the Democrats. It's an outrageous departure and betrayal of a tradition of civil rights advocacy that at least Democratic Party affiliates like to say that they have supported through the years. And we will hope that the voters will make these Democrats pay a price for this kind of vote. Remember, Ben Jealous said that this is the best civil rights lawyer in the country, essentially, or one of the best, especially on the issue of voting rights and arguing voter rights and civil rights law in the country.
You know, I agree with that, and I do hope these Democratic senators pay a price. The one that I knew pretty well, because he was my student at a very prestigious law school at Yale, and he was actually in a human rights clinic with me, and, you know, progressive or at least very liberal like the other students, is Senator Chris Coons, from a Democrat from Delaware. And he made a statement, and it's so outrageous that it's hard to even read it, because what he says is he understands the importance of having legal advocates that fight for, he says, despicable clients, meaning Mamiya. You could put in unpopular clients. He understands the importance of that in our system, and he also understands that an attorney is not responsible for the actions of their client. And then he goes ahead to say, despite this understanding, other people outside of Debo and others have a public campaign that have elevated Mamiya into a political prisoner. And for that reason, these factors lead him to cast a vote that respects the views of those people who are upset that Mamiya has been made into a political prisoner. I mean, it's hard to believe that, because at its core, in my view, at its core, it's utterly racist, actually. Because here you have a black man on trial, given the death penalty, and having him defended by lawyers from the Legal Defense Fund, and yet this senator says, I'm going to listen to the people who hate Mamiya, who believe he should have had the death penalty, even though the court said he shouldn't, and I'm going to vote in that direction. In my view, it's absolutely racist to the core. It also makes me wonder, what about Chris Coons' black constituents in Delaware? What about those? What about those constituents who hated and don't like the death penalty? And so this vote, I agree with you, is most likely a political vote because he's running for re-election. But that makes it even more outrageous, because he's basically undercut fundamental values of this country and really, you know, harmed Mamiya, obviously, and of course harmed Debo, who is going to be probably one of the best civil rights chiefs we were ever going to have. It's really disgusting.
There's so many ways to highlight the politics of race in this perfect storm brewed up against Debo Adegbile. I mean, there are a number of winds blowing through it, but one of them is the politics of race. The more progressive elements of the press have pointed out that white lawyers who are now congressmen have defended people who have even worse and in some ways more despicable crimes under their belts than anything Mumia Abu-Jamal is said to have done. But because we had a white lawyer to the fore here, Debo Adegbile, and we have a militant black figure, Mumia Abu-Jamal, there's a willingness to suspend the right to representation and to place it underneath this righteous indignation about the cop killer designation and all the rest. It is blatantly racist, and it's coming in a time when we have an element of the white demographic that's very concerned about its loss of power, its nation doesn't look like it wants it to look, which means they want it to look white. And so you have Debo Adegbile, Obama, Holder, three black men, and you have voting rights issues. This is another issue we haven't touched in relationship to this, because Debo Adegbile would have the job of deciding which states to sue for voter ID laws that are repressive to African Americans. And recall, we have a 60 to 80,000 strong movement brewing in North Carolina around these issues right now, which isn't covered much in the media. So politically, that dimension of the racial issue is really strong here and blowing into this storm.
Mark, what can our listeners do? Is there a website they can go for information about Educators for Mumia?
Yes, we do have. If you just Google Educators for Mumia Abu-Jamal, it will come right up. I could give you the WW number, but it's a little bit long. I think it's better to just have people Google Educators for Mumia Abu-Jamal. We also have ongoing a defense of one of our supporters over the years, Anthony Montero, Dr. Montero at Temple University, who's defended the black radical tradition for years. And they will find also there a call signed by academics all over the country and the world for Dr. Montero, who's been dismissed seemingly by means of a retaliatory firing at that institution.
And Mark, are we allowed to discuss what happened with Temple News and the running of the ads signed by over 150 prominent intellectuals across the country?
Indeed. Here was an ad headlined by Cornel West, Angela Davis, key white scholars on racial politics like Joe Feagin, David Redeker, Howard Winant, and many others from critical ethnic studies like Gary Okahiro, Farah Jasmine Griffin, and many more, and over 180 faculty from across the land. Temple University News, it's actually called Temple News at Temple University, planned with us for almost 2 weeks for the publishing of this ad yesterday. And the night before, they backed out, with the ad manager saying he just wasn't comfortable with it. He actually had told me that his editor-in-chief thought that it was a risk, that it would expose them to libel. Even when we offered to change the wording of it at the instruction of our attorneys to make them and anybody less liable to libel charges, they would not go with it because they were uncomfortable again, they said. So this at Temple is one sign of the ethos of fear that people are living in, and that's one reason we're fighting this at Temple.
An ethos of fear that runs rampant in the city of Philadelphia, where the police department was under investigation by the Department of Justice years ago for what DOJ attorneys called a behavior that would shock the conscience.
That's exactly the language used, indeed. And one has to wonder if the frenzy of the FOP on this matter is due to a fear that Thabo Adegbile or someone at the federal level might finally open up the case in Philadelphia in this history. Remember, two-thirds of those who investigated Mumia's case eventually went down on corruption charges and graft and this kind of thing. But that's just a start. You also had the DA at the time, then Ed Rendell, who went on to be governor and Democratic National Party chief. Ed Rendell removed from Mumia's case the chief officer investigating Mumia's crime and setting up the case against Mumia, in part because he knew that this chief investigator, Alfonso Giordano, was being investigated by the feds on corruption charges. And indeed, that leading investigator into Mumia's case did face those corruption charges down the line. So there's so much here to be investigated. One has to believe that this FOP frenzy is connected to an ugly past that they just do not want to see the light of day.
Mark, it's such a thorny situation. We really appreciate your commentary and all the fine work you're doing with educators from Mumia and other groups, and it's just been a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder.
Okay, there's a whole new generation of young activists and students that are bearing us up, so that's the good news of the moment.
That's certainly good news. Thank you, Mark.
Okay.
Thanks a great day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
important recent article, Ukraine and the Pathology of America's Liberal Worldview, an African-American Perspective, our returning guest, Ajamu Baraka, calls it a massive cognitive deficiency that President Obama has asked Congress to agree on a billion-dollar package of aid for the Ukraine. Meanwhile, the elite opinion in the United States has embraced the position that cuts in public expenditures and services at every level of government are a reasonable and unavoidable necessity. Baraka says the crisis is here in the United States. Today he joins us from Colombia, South America. Ajamu Baraka is on the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights as well as the Institute for Policy Studies.
Ajamu Baraka, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
Speaking to you all the way from Colombia, South America.
Yes.
Ajamu, you wrote a very good article in Counterpunch recently titled Ukraine and the Pathology of the Liberal Worldview. You call the new government in the Ukraine come into power as a result of a so-called revolution. And this new government in the Ukraine, let's talk about that. How did it get there? Who put them in power? And what do you think they want to do?
Well, I mean, it's clear that there was, in fact, legitimate social opposition in Ukraine to some of the policies of the government there, and there was an attempt to express some of those concerns that quickly were taken advantage of by some elements of the Ukrainian society that have been associated with some of the more dangerous elements, fascist elements that have been aligned with the far right for decades, who were involved in the demonstrations that were organized, that quickly moved from legitimate expressions of opposition to pitched battles in the streets. Some of those right-wing forces ended up as the primary shock troops, engaged in all kinds of violent activities that eventually led to a situation where the government felt compelled to engage in a dialogue, and a three-country tripartite process was put in place, and a decision or an agreement was made in which the protesters had won most of their demands in terms of political reforms, and but that agreement was jettisoned by those right-wing forces, and the result was that basically they stormed the institutions of the government and proclaimed themselves the new government of Ukraine, and from that ensued the crisis that we're now experiencing. So there's a real danger in characterizing this as a popular revolution. It's clear that more than half of the population in Ukraine was still not convinced that a revolutionary movement was, in fact, called for, and one in which it clearly violated the tenets of the Ukrainian constitution. And even more so, there's real concern among very large sectors of the population that because of the right-wing character of some of the leading organizations, and some of the decisions they made once they seized power, eliminating the right to practice to use the Russian language, withdrawing the autonomy process of Crimea, it became clear that the character of this revolution was one that was not really committed to social change.
Ajamu, you know, I've been looking at, you know, the situation for a few years on what I would call the periphery states between Europe and the former Soviet Union or Russia. And, you know, what I've sort of seen is efforts by EU and the U.S. to push into Russia, whether it was in Georgia or Iran or in the Ukraine. And in my view, there was, you know, a big role of U.S. and EU in, yes, taking this popular discontent by some parts of the Ukrainian people, but also pushing that in a Western way to try and detach at least Ukraine which was a breadbasket for Russia, detach it from really Russia and move it more toward the EU. Is that your understanding as well?
It is, Michael, and it's a very dangerous, and some people might characterize as reckless, a move that was made, in particular back in November, when the EU basically forced the Ukrainian authorities to make a decision between moving closer toward the European Union or rejecting its close association structural connections with Russia. Even Putin said himself that this was a decision that was not necessary to be forced on the Ukrainian authorities. But it's been part of a very aggressive strategy that's been pursued by various administrations over the last almost 20 years. We all recall that one of the concessions made by the Soviet Union once it was basically imploding was that in order for the Soviets to take their troops out of Eastern Europe, at that time they had something like 380,000 troops in Eastern Europe, that the U.S. administration committed that it was not going to expand NATO toward the east. Well, we all know what happened, as a consequence. So, that expansion of NATO, the fairly aggressive policies over the last couple of years, I think has convinced the Russian authorities that trying to maintain a relationship with the West, in which they're going to be respected as equals, has failed them.
Ajamu, could you contrast the U.S. government's response to the Ukraine with its glaring failure to help our own city of Detroit?
That is one of the, it's interesting because some folks have wondered about making that connection. But for many of us, the connection was very clear that here we have a situation in the city of Detroit that basically is bankrupt as a consequence of the activities of these predatory banks and the disintegration of the U.S. economy and its urban cores. But the administration, once the city officials went to the administration looking for assistance, of course, the line was, there's no assistance for you. And it's not just Detroit. It's across the country. We see and we saw that in December, the Congress, in their striking their budget deal, they basically eliminated unemployment benefits for long-term unemployed, saving $25 billion. So when it comes to the American people, working class people, the poor, there's no money. There's only growing austerity. But when it comes to advancing the interests of what many of us refer to as the empire, they can always find resources. So the $1 billion package for Ukraine is in stark contrast to the line that there's no resources to bail out the people of Detroit. And that's a glaring contradiction that really reflects where the real priorities lie.
Well, really, Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, was bragging about how the United States had put $5 billion into the Ukraine in the last 10 years and how they've supported hundreds of NGOs. My take on it is that this really is a U.S.-instigated coup in the Ukraine designed to marginalize Russian capitalist influence and to bring in American capitalist influence and investments, and to also push aside the European Union. And the Ukraine, I think, is really a treasure if the United States can get its hands on it. And what I'm afraid of is that just like we've seen austerity in this country in terms of not helping people who really need help, that you're going to see a program supported by the United States of instituting austerity in the Ukraine. That's what this all means. What is your reaction to that observation?
Of course, that's exactly what will happen. All we have to do is look at what is happening in the southern cone of Europe in terms of the austerity policies being imposed on all those countries. And the fact that there are no resources to really bail out these countries. But basically, the real winners in the Ukrainian chess game, if you will, will ultimately be the U.S. capital. And there will be some European capital that would benefit also. And that's really one of the sad parts about this, is that people are facing some desperate times throughout Europe, and in particular in Eastern Europe. And they believe, the people of Ukraine, some of them thought that by further integrating themselves with the European Union, that they would in some way benefit from being part of that process. And they look at some of their comrades in Poland who were able to leave Poland and get to London and get their menial jobs, and something that they should aspire to. So they thought that there would be some kind of material benefit by integrating closer into the European process. But we all know that the objective reality will be that basically the only winners will be big capital, that the Ukrainian economy would be forced to be opened up, the financial sector will be exposed, banks will be taken over, whatever state industries that are viable will be seized, privatized. There will be massive unemployment, because part of the agreement for the IMF loans, of course, would be structural adjustment and downsizing government employment, so there'd be more government employment in those industries that would be seized. There will be more unemployment because they're going to streamline their labor force and move toward more capital-intensive production processes. The Ukrainian workers will find that not only will their wages not increase, but probably will be further eroded, because you know they will be in competition with other poor workers throughout Eastern Europe. So it's a unfortunate a myth that many people in the country have embraced. It was driving some of the opposition. But again, the only ones who really win with this kind of integration would be big capital. And that's why the U.S. is salivating at the prospects of being able to penetrate the Ukrainian economy.
We're speaking with Ajaimu Baraka, who has written a recent article in Counterpunch called Ukraine and the Pathology of the Liberal Worldview. Ajaimu, in your article, you talk about the willingness of the United States to align itself with right-wing and ultra-right-wing forces. And I wanted to ask you about that with respect to the Ukraine and other countries like Libya. In the Ukraine, for example, the Svoboda Party, the Freedom Party, has its roots in the Social Nationalist Party, which was a Nazi party. Of course, the Nazis called themselves National Socialists. And the United States has got Victoria Nuland, the ambassador from the State Department, out there handing out cookies and being in solidarity with that party. You got John McCain out there talking about freedom, standing next to these Nazi-like figures. And what's your take on American politicians be willing to do that and say with respect to what they did in Libya?
Well, it's a very dangerous undertaking, and something that, for reasons that are not really that clear to me, many folks in the West and in the U.S. don't seem to be able to recognize this growing threat, this tendency to align themselves with some of the most reactionary elements on the planet in order to ensure their hegemony and to further their influence. I mean, we have to see this as the way I see it, as a global strategy on the part of U.S. and Western imperialism. And the alignment that they have made with what everybody knows to be fascist elements in Ukraine is very similar to the kinds of alignments that are being made in slightly different ways with the radical right in Venezuela, with the continued support of the right-wing government in Israel, with the decisions that were made strategically that were termed the new redirection during the last years of the Bush administration, to basically to align themselves with Sunni extremists, Islamist extremists in the Middle East, in order to advance their interests. And we see that being played out in Syria. So in the global context of an argument where people were making that the U.S. was on a decline and the Western world was on a decline, what we see, in fact, is a counter-revolutionary strategy based on closer alignments with right-wing forces throughout the world. And that kind of analysis has to become a center of more attention, because what we have in the West and in the U.S. in particular is mass confusion among left forces, in which they continue to find themselves for various reasons on the same side as U.S. imperialism in these various situations across the planet. So it wasn't surprising. What's surprising is how about the alignment in Ukraine. What's been a little surprising is the ease in which the rebranding of those fascist forces have been successful in the U.S. media.
It was really disturbing to see that a lot of people who would identify themselves as progressives here in this country got confused by the whole thing. I think they saw masses of people out in the street, and they automatically thought, well, this is good. But if those masses of people are being led by the fascist forces that you identify, that are writing "Jews live here" on the walls of people's homes, and are beating up and tearing up the newspapers of socialists, and who are actually shooting into the crowd as a pretext for the repression, that's not a good thing. And I think that there was a lot of confusion in the movement in the United States about what's actually going on there.
Well, I mean, well, look, one of the moves that were made by the coup makers was to outlaw the Ukrainian Communist Party. So, yes, there's been mass confusion. I mean, people seem to not be able to differentiate between the left and the right. All they see is opposition, and the opposition is enough for them to then align themselves with it. I mean, it's a very dangerously unsophisticated position, but it's one in which I think is reflective of the consequence of the entire political spectrum in the U.S. and in Western Europe moving toward the right. And not only in terms of how they see the world, but a kind of intellectual laziness that is very, very dangerous, not only for all of us, but in particular for some of us who are from communities in which we still find ourselves as numerical minorities. The ability to build coalitions and alignments with traditional left and even liberal forces are now being completely, almost completely eliminated because of this right-wing movement.
Ajamu, we only have a few minutes left. I wanted to read part of what you wrote. You write, in the U.S., where an African-American is being murdered by police forces and vigilantes at a pace of one every 28 hours, where a million of our folks are entombed in the dungeons of this nation's prisons, where state laws are being employed to deny us our democratic rights, where ex-Panther Eddie Conroy is finally released from prison after 44 years, still leaving dozens of our political prisoners who are going into their fourth and fifth decades in prison, African-American radicals must be clear on the principal enemy and the principal contradiction. And you write, in conclusion, the enemy and the principal contradiction is not on the other side of the world in Russia. What words would you have for activists and organizers in this country?
For us to remember the long tradition of resistance that we are part of here in this country, a resistance that has been committed to the broadest and highest principles of social justice, one in which we were able to clearly identify the enemy, along with the kinds of ideals we were fighting for. That we have to reclaim. We have to see clearly that our principal enemies are the same enemies that most of the people of the world have identified as the enemy, and that is U.S. and Western imperialism. It doesn't mean that we gloss over the internal contradictions in various countries, but the principal enemy and the principal contradiction for the world now is U.S. and Western imperialism. And that reality, that political stance, we have to re-embrace. And that's the only way we're going to be able to transcend the kind of political confusion that we have on the left at this current moment.
Beautifully put, Ajamu Baraka. It's been a pleasure to have you on again.
Thank you. It's been
Thank
a pleasure.
You, Ajamu. Thank you, Ajamu. You take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.